This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm talking this morning to Arslan Ahmad, a council member of the Association of Islamic Banking and Financial Institutions Malaysia, otherwise known as IBIM, and also the chief executive of HSBC Amanah Malaysia, which is the Islamic banking arm of the bank. Oz, thanks for talking to me. Now, we're 2 days away from the end of the loan moratorium period. Give us a bit of a situation update in terms of whether Malaysians in general have subscribed to obviously the second wave, the second phase of the debt relief measures.
Well, firstly, thank you very much for having me. And secondly, thank you to BFM for spending some time to focus on this really important topic. I do have some fresh numbers for you. So as of the 18th of September, banks have reached out to over 2 million folks. Now, look, that focus is definitely going to be on the folks that we think are most vulnerable. From that, 1.4 million have been engaged in an active dialogue and 430,000 have accepted some type of further intervention. So those numbers are of the 18th of September. So clearly there will be movement in those numbers between then and now, as in the 10 days past. So those are fresh kind of numbers in terms of the progress that have been made, specifically on those targeted 2+ million.
So 2 million out of a possible how many?
Well, so when we're talking about the 2 million, those are the ones that you say, look, let's have a look at our book across the industry as a industry as a sector. And who do you think are going to be vulnerable that might be requiring that targeted assistance? So it's them. So it's targeting the most vulnerable.
And of course, presumably you're speaking on behalf of the entire industry, not just on the Amanah side. Yeah. OK, so what kind of, I guess it's all about a bit of a snapshot from you in terms of how prepared or otherwise the borrowers are for the end of the loan moratorium period, because there's a lot of concern among merchants, among the banking, among the industry in general, that people and businesses are not prepared for the fallout from the end of the debt relief period.
So I think that we have to be very transparent in this time and say, do we know the extent of what's going to happen in the weeks after, into the first weeks of October? The answer to that is we don't know. But what we can say is that, look, number one, there are a group of people who, when there was the blanket moratorium, turned around and said, look, we're going to opt out. So we know that. We know for a fact that even in this period of reaching out to 2 million people who plus who are considered vulnerable, SMEs and individuals, people said, no, we're okay. And also, we know that folks are going off to other areas such as the Pirhatin or the Penjana Fund or even AKPK. So I think the question becomes, out of the folks from the 2 million that are not responding, what's happening there? And I think there's a key message, and I'd like to take the opportunity, given that we're on BFM and a wide listenership, to say, look, folks, please do go and contact banks. Talk to them about your situation, even if you just want to clarify something. And I suppose the question becomes, why aren't people doing it? We can go through that, but the one thing I want to reassure listeners is, look, whatever you do post this blanket moratorium and what you do afterwards will not impact your secrets. But look, if you don't do anything, and then suddenly you have to repay and you're not paying, that could impact your secrets. So I think that's a really important message to please engage, especially for those who may be fearful and are hesitating.
Well, we've seen the Malaysian government take a more targeted approach to this whole the whole shift in paradigm. But we've also seen Singapore being quite preemptive in terms of extending debt relief measures beyond December 31st. So they've taken a much more, as you would expect them to, of course, take a much more micromanaged approach. But it goes beyond just individuals, it's also the businesses as well. And there's two phases to this, isn't it, Arslan? Oz, one is survival and one is just staying within the commercially viable space. The other one goes beyond that into the realms of consumption and investment and hiring and all that kind of recruitment discussion. And of course, at stake, therefore, is the country's economy and whether we're going to progress and hit that V-shaped recovery into the second half of 2020 and 2021. What is your feel of that? What is your sense of that?
Well, let me break that up into two parts, which is what are the types of intervention going forward? We've had a blanket view of, for example, moratorium, particularly focused on SMEs and individuals, and now we're moving into something more targeted. That is the right thing for Malaysia. As mentioned, there are people who are opting out, so that's one part. The targeted approach is the correct approach. There needs to be a piece around engagement and making sure people are talking, which we've just covered, so that's right. Then when we kind of look at what happens afterwards, there's a significant amount that the government has done, for example, in the different funds I just mentioned, the Pahatin and Penjana. In fact, if you go to the sites on that, you'll see different categorizations for people to avail, particularly focused around SMEs, who are a significant employer within the Malaysian market. Remember, that links directly to individuals, where they're getting their salaries and paying off their financing. Well, it's you know, significantly focused on SMEs. So that's one side of what Malaysia has done. We're no doubt going to find different countries doing different things. And I suppose we're only really going to know once the dust has settled. So I think right now, just coming together and focusing on the different parts, you know, get in touch with either the banks or whether they're funds or so on and so forth, where you think you need support. That's the critical part, engagement and communication.
Well, given your admission, Oz, that you don't know what you don't know, and this could be a big uncertainty going into the final quarter of the year. What I do understand is that the banking sector has allowed borrowers to restructure and reduce their encumbrances, but it's not a blanket moratorium anymore. So do you think the private sector, the banking sector, should do more and be more proactive?
Yeah, so let me just section them out so it's clear what there is. For individuals who've lost their jobs up until the end of this year, so all of this year, they can extend the moratorium by 3 months. For folks who have had a reduction in salary, they can get a six-month lower installment amount. And then we talk about absolutely everybody else can have a case-by-case arrangement where banks are changing their processes and turnaround times in terms of SOP to make that more agile. They can have different arrangements that may be interest-only or profit-only in the case of Islamic. That may be extending tenor, lowering the amounts of installment. Of course, there's the other side. Some folks will be saying, listen, I want to pay off my accrued profit over the moratorium and carry on paying my installment amount as it was pre the blanket moratorium. And some people also will be saying, look, just increase my installment amount. So there's a huge amount of flexibility, and that's the right thing, because we have to remember one thing. We've moved from MCO to recovery MCO. We've moved from businesses not being able to do stuff to business being able to do stuff. And that's why the response is therefore changed as well, which I think has been based on the information that we have in this huge amount of uncertainty, the right evidence and based on the information that we had decision.
Okay, let's also go a bit macro, because we're a few weeks away, Oz, from the Budget 2021 announcements. What is your sense, given my assumption that you've been at IBM discussing with the Ministry of Finance, what is your sense of what's in store for us in Budget 2021 in terms of possible, you know, further mitigation measures for the economy?
Well, look, we haven't had discussions talking about the budget specifically that I am cited on or can speak about. But the question is about where are banks and how well are banks positioned? Now, if you look at some of the decisions banks are making in terms of engaging, making sure people are able to meet their obligations or restructure appropriately, what it's allowing also banks to do is keep capital positions in a decent level. So when there is a recovery, and we hope to God that this thing we're under goes as soon as possible, but when there is economic recovery, banks are well capitalized in order to provide financing for those who actually are seeking it with an uptake of the economy. So that's certainly what banks would be looking to do, making sure that there's capital there to support an upswing in the economy.
And that's exactly what we'll be talking to about after the break. I'm talking this morning to Arslan Ahmad, the council member of IBM, Association of Islamic Banking and Financial Institutions Malaysia, and also the chief executive of HSBC Amanah Malaysia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Oz Ahmad, council member of IBM and chief executive of HSBC. Aman Ahmad Malaysia on the grill with me this morning. Now, let's go further into the financial sector, Oz, and look at the, what I've seen are the June 2020 numbers from HSBC Malaysia. And there are certain numbers which are expanding on the impairments front. There's interesting expansions in terms of the manufacturing sector, wholesale and retail trade, household retail. And that's not surprising given the lockdowns. I guess in a more general sense, where is the banking sector in all this, given its importance as a systemic contributor to the overall economy?
Well, I'm very glad you've asked that question. And look, as you know, we're in closed period for HSBC, so I can't speak about HSBC specifically. But this is a very interesting topic for people to understand, linking it back to the fact, look, we've got to have the capital and got to be ready for the upswing. So when we look at impairments, we have to look at it in the context of what's called expected credit losses.
The ECLs, yeah?
Yeah, so this is a technical point, right? So I just want to just send people to sleep for about 10 seconds to explain it, because I think it's really important that we understand, not just from a point of view of having the capital, financial stability and depositors, people we don't talk enough about. So ECLs, expected credit losses, is actually a function of what does the forecast look like, GDP forecast and so on and so forth, regardless of whether your book's performing or not, right? So there will be an impact that has to be imputed in when there has been a change. And clearly there has been a big change in economic forecasts. So that's going to impact banks generally. Of course, that ECL is heightened when there's a credit deterioration. So something is not doing as well as it was doing. So that's then the factor increases on that. So it's one, then plus two. It's called stage one and stage two. And then there's last thing that's called stage three, which is actual impairments. So it is quite normal that what you will see in the banking sector in the June results is an increase on that impairment or expected credit loss line. Now, why is that important to manage for banks? And actually, there's a double whammy, because there's something called a modification loss, which is a very technical point around when you don't get what you're supposed to be getting in terms of timing, you have to account for that. And that's that comes into the cost line as well. So now, banks are dealing with that, but at the same time, they're dealing with two critical factors broadly under the one umbrella of financial stability. We've talked quite a lot about the fact you need the good capital basis in order to support an upswing. Now, just before I pivot to the other point, I want to note that given that we're in a very well-regulated environment, the policy and supervision folks at Bank Negara will obviously, on an ongoing basis, making sure that banks' capital positions are robust to support the economy. So that's one kind of oversight, but it's naturally in the interest of banks to do that. The other side, when we talk about financial stability, are depositors. And I just want to spend a little bit speaking about them. And often we talk about depositors as a category, but we have to understand that the majority of depositors, who are they? They're people who work hard, 9 to 5, 5 days a week, put their money into a bank, you know, in order to keep it safe and hopefully save a bit to meet whatever hopes and ambitions and dreams they have for themselves and their family. So banks also need to maintain a strong capital position for financial stability to talk about, yes, the ability to support the economy on upswing, but also ensuring the safety of depositors.
Yeah, it's a uniquely Malaysian thing, Oz, because we've got this ecosystem that's been built up in Malaysia whereby if the banks don't do well, the country doesn't do well, because by virtue of the ownership structures, and then which then plays into the PNBs and the co-ops and the EPFs as well, which then pay unit trust returns and what have you, right? Have we worked ourselves into a bit of a knot in terms of not having much wiggle room, therefore? Because I presume that what you've just described in terms of deterioration in credit quality has, I guess, in a way, forced the Ministry of Finance's hand to not allow the blanket debt moratorium to go beyond September 2020.
Well, I think that we need to take that into two parts. One is whether the blanket moratorium was the best thing to do going forward. And I think that that's quite independent of performance, which I'll get onto the link you're making around where the dividends go up to, yeah, which is a good point. I think that taking something targeted is always better in order we can focus resource and time into those who have a specific requirement, because there will be those who don't. So I think that that is independently the right thing in terms of the data that we had and the decision to be taking forward. Separately, I think what here we're talking about is that trade-off between maintaining the financial stability, but also understanding where profits tend to go to in the industry, which is up to the main shareholders, which tend to be the stock market or funds, who then at the back of that are unit holders.
Exactly.
Right. So, yeah, of course, there's a natural trade-off there in terms of the optimal thing in terms of financial stability, but also paying that out. I mean, that's something that each individual institution will need to look at.
Yeah, well, the urban discussion has also, among lay people, has been that the banking sector has been enjoying fat margins for a very long time. And this could be one of those years where it gives a little bit back to the people. Now, would that be a fair assumption for the lay people to consider for you?
So when we look at where what banks are doing effectively, and this is really important to understand, that what we're doing is that we have depositors' money where we're safely looking to finance that to maintain the safety of the depositors' monies that they've deposited and out. So when we talk about where there is potential margin, what we're talking about when it comes to banking is that we're looking at debt product, and those typically have the lowest margins, which is why people like to take debt. So that's just, you know, if we look at other sectors that may have, you know, risk reward where the rewards are higher. So I think that that's a general point. Banks are in the business of doing debt financing, which tends to be more slender margins. When we talk about when banks make money, we've spoken about the point around the profits that are made and dividends and where a significant amount of that capital lands within Malaysia. What happens to the rest of it? It goes into the capital base to ensure that banks can continue to grow and finance and have stability for times like this, where you see ECLs getting impacted, but banks have buffers to be able to support an upswing. So it's very important for people to understand where that flow of money is. And I think that then if they look at that, they can see it in a different perspective.
I'm talking this morning to Oz Ahmad, the council member of IBIM and the chief executive of HSBC Amanah Malaysia. And this is where the discussion becomes a little bit more complex, because if the banking sector does well and more credit flows into the economy, people can then, you know, obviously have a bit of an expansion, and then everybody benefits as a result of the rising tide lifting all boats. Now, loans growth is said to be somewhere in the low single digits this year. And we've seen The Edge this morning writing about how the banking sector has never been this cheap by way of valuations on a price-to-book basis for the longest time. Do you think this is essentially the trough for the sector, Oz? And where do you see the sector going forward for the next 3 months?
Yeah, so I mean, so let's break that into two. We've got a part here that's certainly around the growth of loan assets, and understandably, given what's happened, we would naturally see that to be very low considering history. But we're not in a BAU situation. I think we'll see that reflected in many geographies as well. Then in terms of stock market activity, it would also be natural where people are kind of being a bit controlled in what they're investing in and so on and so forth. You'll see the impact of, yes, because banks aren't doing as much in terms of actual activity. So that's the revenue line, because there isn't as much activity happening. You also see the impact of the cost line. And we've talked a little bit about that in terms of the ECLs and therefore kind of what the profit numbers are. We'll see clearly that flow through for any organization, not just banks, in terms of their valuation. Then you compound that also with the fact that people are probably saying, look, I'm just going to be a bit more conservative. So both of those factors would naturally impact the sector.
Yeah, there's
or
some,
any sector.
There are some indications, Oz, in terms of an uptick in mortgage financing. I think some HP as well, higher purchase, and some personal financing products, as according to AmInvest and I think Afin Huang as well. Is that something you're experiencing at the Islamic banking side as well?
Yeah, so I can't specifically talk about HSBC as we're in closed period, but also I don't have the numbers for the Islamic banking sector as now. But typically what you would see generally is that the Islamic banking sector grows faster than the conventional banking sector has done for a while.
Why is that?
Well, it's a simple matter of demand. People, it's a majority Muslim country. There is a preference, all things being equal, to be Sharia compliant. We've seen an expansion over the last 10 years of capital within the Islamic banking space. And as a result, you know, there's more access for people to take those solutions. A number of banks have taken measures to kind of grow their Islamic businesses as well. But that's just a...
Yeah, so snapshot from you in terms of a broad ratio, if you could, Oz, what is the percentage of Islamic Sharia assets of the entire conventional general banking sector versus the conventional, which I'm sure has been rising in the last few years?
Yeah, it has been rising in the last few years. I mean, it got to, I think, the around 28 to 30%. And then what I think you're going to see this year, though I haven't seen the numbers, because a lot of people will be taking unutilized lines, corporates, a lot of the capital is in the conventional banking space. So you may see a kind of change from the typical ratio. It was something like, I think it was the 2019 numbers were the conventional banking space was growing at 3% and Islamic in 8%. I think that ratio might be slightly different because of this nuanced point I'm making around unutilized lines being used up. But I think that over the long term, we'll continue to see that growth. And there are macro reasons for it. Look, if you look at the capital markets, the Sukuk market is bigger than the bond market in Malaysia already. That's naturally the case. I think 70-plus percent of the stock exchange is listed as Sharia compliant. And now people have to understand, why is that so? Because investors who are neutral are looking at credit. Investors who are partial are looking at credit and Sharia compliance. So you want to get both sets of investors into anything. Therefore, I think you'll naturally see Islamic finance grow at a faster pace than conventional.
Yeah, I think that's what the Bursa Malaysia chairman said recently as well. But in terms of the expansion and the uptick in credit demand the last few weeks, obviously a lot of it has been due to the fact that the central bank has been cutting rates. And I think we've got one more meeting before the end of the year. There was some thought that could happen in September. It didn't. One more meeting, I think, in November. What is your sense of whether Bank Negara cuts to 1.5% OPR or not?
Well, look, I think that what the decision will fundamentally be based on information that dictates, is that a useful thing to support from a monetary policy, the economy. I think that's what it's going to be a function of.
Yeah, unemployment activity.
Yeah, and I think the sense is that, you know, you want to take the most up-to-date data, which including the October data. So I couldn't possibly give a view on what I thought would happen. But what I think we have seen has always been, whether it's on the monetary space or the policy space, a proactive position taken by BNM.
Yeah, also, I think until now we've been very technical and quite jargonish in terms of our discussion. Let's spend the last couple of minutes, if you can, and just give us a bit of a, you know, a layperson's perspective in terms of whether Malaysia will experience that much wanted V-shaped recovery as we enter the end of the year and into 2021.
Right. Okay. So, look, if we are going to take away from the jargon piece, and we're going to talk about we're in this country, and we're going to try and do our best, what we have to talk about is just coming together and trying to listen to the one or two messages that each other is telling. When it comes to the banking sector, the one thing that we want to be able to do is make sure we've spoken to everybody who's vulnerable in order to make sure that they're set up for from now until the end of the year so banks can focus and have conversations with their corporate clients or otherwise around how they can support whatever they might be doing whenever whatever stimulus might be coming in, what innovation they might be working on. So what I would say is that we cannot put a stake in the ground of whether it will be a V, but what we can do is come together to do as much as possible to try and make that happen.
And very quickly, Oz, if the borrowers really actually unfortunately have no inkling about the full fallout potentially of not coming to you and having a discussion, what other last-minute relief measures might be available to them?
Look, the thing is, even if they miss the deadline, they can still come and talk because they can still avail it after the deadline. I think that's point number one. That's important to go. There are other measures that people can talk. If we're talking about individuals, they can speak to AKPK, for example. And what I would do, if there was one message, sorry, if there's two messages, what to leave with is, number one, look, please speak to someone, whether it's the bank or AKPK. And the other one is to employers of folks, please provide them any kind of documentation or support documentation they need on a timely basis. So these would be the two messages I'd implore folks to do as we try and all work together to navigate this, you know, just unprecedented time.
Well, Oz, you said two messages. I think you might mean three because you've also got final birthday wishes to send to somebody.
Oh, that's right. So I just wanted to thank you so much. I just want to wish my daughter Nuha a happy 10th birthday. Love you, darling.
Fantastic. Oz Ahmad, Council Member of IBIM and Chief Executive of HSBC Amanah Malaysia, with us on The Grill, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.